Today is May 15th, 2019. Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, and Amazon are using your personal data? Is that product you bought from Amazon a counterfeit? You should find out. Our website is pcradioshow.org, and we can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet, as well as on various podcast hosting sites. Podcasts of the programs available on prn.fm on the Internet and pcradioshow.org. To listen to the live program on the telephone each Wednesday, 6 p.m. Eastern Time, the number is 641-793-7091. And for those who are listening to the program on demand, you can leave us a message with your question or comments to hank@pcradioshow.org. You can also reach us on Google number 862-800-6805. Start your message with the Personal Computer Show, followed by your message. In a global economy with a need to communicate worldwide, communications could be like the Wild West, where it would be a free-for-all in traffic. A single satellite in a geostationary orbit, often referred to as geosynchronous equatorial orbit, 22,236 miles above Earth's equator and following the direction of Earth's rotation, will appear motionless at a fixed position in the sky to ground observers. Five such satellites can blanket the globe. If you were to just ping a satellite at the speed of light, it would take about an eighth of a second. With packet switching, the handshaking between the two points would be measured in seconds. How can you speed up the speed of transmission? Place the satellite in low orbit to cut the distance between the base station and the satellite. If you did that, how many satellites would you need to blanket the globe? Well, Amazon is working on launching a home internet service by launching satellites into low Earth orbit. Recently, SpaceX received FCC approval to do the same, offering their own internet service. Now, according to a study from Broadband Now, these new services will drive down the cost of home internet. That's good. This savings could add up to as much as $30 billion every year. This happens because markets with more than two internet providers charge less for home internet, according to Broadband Now. SpaceX just received approval from the FCC to launch 4,425 satellites to build a low Earth orbit network to sell home internet. Unlike current satellite internet, these satellites will be in a far lower orbit and offer far faster speeds without the data caps current satellite systems use. The goal is that this new system will offer robust, high-speed internet, especially in developing countries and rural parts of developed nations like in the United States. While you may not be running out to buy this if you have fiber internet, it could bring true wireless internet options to Americans who currently have no real options. Amazon is planning to launch 3,236 satellites to build a network, providing global high-speed internet, unlike current satellite internet. These devices will be in a far lower orbit and offer faster speeds than current satellite systems. Has anyone asked the question, if other countries want to compete, do you think they would really seek approval from the FCC? They would just go ahead with their own program. With tens of thousands of low-orbit satellites, where and who is a traffic controller to assign orbital positions? You would also need to schedule interstellar space launches to not crash into low-orbit satellites. Can you imagine a space program to Mars can be derailed because of the window of opportunity to launch would interfere with thousands upon thousands of low-orbit satellites? Is anyone thinking ahead? This Monday, the Supreme Court ruled that iPhone owners can sue Apple for monopolizing the App Store. A group of iPhone owners accusing Apple of violating U.S. antitrust rules because of its App Store monopoly can sue the company. Justice Brett Kavanaugh, in the majority opinion, said that when retailers engage in unlawful, anti-competitive conduct that harms consumers, people buying those companies' products have the right to hold the businesses to account. The court's four liberal justices joined Kavanaugh in the 5-4 decision. The Supreme Court opinion notably does not accuse Apple of violating antitrust law. It holds that consumers have the right to sue the company for monopolistic behavior because they purchase apps directly from Apple. The ruling could have wide implications for other tech companies that operate similarly walled-off online storefronts. It definitely should make tech companies wonder how the antitrust laws will be applied going forward in an online platform environment. The case stems from a 2011 class action suit by iPhone owners alleging that by taking a 30% cut of app sales, Apple has encouraged app developers to raise their prices in response. Consumers have been harmed by the practice, the suit claimed, because Apple does not allow customers to download apps from any other source other than the iTunes App Store. Unlike Android, iOS customers can only get apps from that official source, which Apple says serves as a kind of a quality control to weed out security threats and apps that violate the company's term of service. Apple argued that the iPhone owners do not have the right to sue because Apple is an intermediary, but the Supreme Court held that iPhone owners have a direct purchaser relationship with Apple and may sue under a precedent known as Illinois' BRIC. Had Apple been allowed to set the terms of the legal fight, the court said, it would have hindered the ability of consumer to seek relief from alleged monopolists. The Supreme Court opinion that Apple's line drawing does not make a lot of sense other than as a way to gerrymander Apple out of this and similar lawsuits. Antitrust experts also welcome the court's reasoning that allowing Apple to avoid the class action suit would provide a roadmap for others to evade the law. The Supreme Court did not rule on the customer's likelihood of success, only that they have the right to sue. Apple argued that it was not a monopoly, rather just a platform for app developers who can set their own prices. It had said that if the court allowed the case to proceed, it would disrupt the e-commerce market. Going forward, we will be following this to see how it turns out. During the past month of April, New Yorkers were flooded with 112 robocalls per second. Phone scammers badgered New Yorkers with an eye-popping 293 million robocalls in April alone. That figure averages out to 112 calls per second and 11 calls per New Yorker. In New York City alone, there were 142 million such calls reported. That's about half the total. Those with citywide 917 area codes endured the most bother, with 48 million calls going to those numbers in April. That's about half of the New York City robocalls. Customers with the outer borough, with the number 347 prefix, had the second most with 42 million calls. Meanwhile, and I was shocked by this, a relatively few 2 million spam calls went to 212 Manhattan area code. The TRACED Act, which presently has the support of 53 senators and 14 House members, aimed to cut the cord on scammers by ratcheting up fines to $10,000 per bogus call, while also extending the statute of limitation for punishing perpetrators from 1 year to 3 years after each incident. The annoying calls come for all sorts of reasons, but almost none of them are legitimate. Sometimes callers pose as insurance companies or government officials to con people into handing them money. Other scams involve calling from disguised long-distance numbers and hanging up so the victims call back and rack up immense long-distance bills. And I was surprised by this. Phone scammers are making more money than ever, and their easiest targets are millennials and men, according to a new report. Americans have lost an estimated $10.5 billion to phone scams in the last 12 months, up from about $8.9 billion in the prior 12-month period, according to a report from Truecaller, a caller ID and spam call blocking app. In Truecaller's fifth annual survey, men and millennials are most likely to lose money to a phone scam, particularly men between the ages of 18 and 34. Truecaller reported the following, that the data continuously reveals that men, particularly millennial-age men, are the most vulnerable to phone scams. This shows that despite millennials growing up surrounded by technology, truly anyone can be a victim when it comes to a phone scam. And the odds are increasing. Almost 1 in 6 Americans reported losing money to scams over the last 12 months, compared to 1 in 10 in the prior period of those scammed. The average loss was $244 per victim. There has been an increase in persistent spam calls, and that's one factor behind the numbers. Numbers up 39% from the previous 12-month period. Truecaller reported that in the most recent 12-month period, spam calls averaged 32 per month, while spam text messages average 11 per month, compared to 23 calls in the prior period. Most of those were robocalls, according to the report, and that comes to approximately 97.2 billion spam-related calls and more than 34 billion spam texts in the United States alone. Scams claiming great deals such as low-interest loans and better credit card rates were the most common scam in the past 12 months. But over half of Americans received negative unsolicited calls, including problems with account or you owe money or political calls. Well, technically, political calls is not considered a bad robocall because it's allowed by law. But it should not be allowed by law, and the reason why it's allowed by law is because the politicians passed the law that says political calls are fine. In order to avoid speaking on the phone, over half of Americans, 55%, prefer to use text, social media apps, and email. This figure jumps among younger Americans ages 18 to 34, with 73% saying they favor other forms of communication to avoid talking on the phone, and that's much higher than for older Americans who are 55 and up, who don't shy away from speaking on the phone nearly as much. Despite the heightened awareness of scam and spam calls, the sophistication in which people are being scammed has skyrocketed with new technology being developed, such as AI and voice recognition. Scammers are able to reach so many people, and the data shows that many of these people are falling victim not only once, but several times. Robocalls also have the ability to call thousands, if not millions, of people at once. So Americans are getting hit at a much larger scale that shows no sign of slowing down. We need more than just a law. We need some intelligent laws. FCC promises yet again to tackle robocalls. FCC Commissioner Pai made 2 announcements on Monday. He expects major phone companies to implement Shaken and Stir caller ID authentication standards this year. He will hold a summit on July 11th to examine industry progress toward meeting this deadline. The announcement was heralded by the FCC as another significant step in the organization's fight against robocalls. Pai said the exact same thing 3 months ago, and the exact same thing 3 months before that. On February 13th, Chairman Pai iterated his call for a robust caller ID authentication system to combat illegal caller ID spoofing. And 3 months before that, November 2018, the announcement was FCC Chairman Pai today demanded that the phone industry adopt a robust call authentication system to combat illegal caller ID spoofing and launch that system no later than next year. And every 3 months, it's the same thing. And every 3 months, nothing has progressed or changed. In the meantime, the telcos ring up more profits from all those annoying robocalls, and everyone else gets inconvenience. There are 3 things the FCC can do today. Require core authentication technology. Right now, it's not required, it's just asking the telcos to do it. Make available free tools to consumers to block these annoying automated calls, and set up an FCC robocall enforcement division. In other words, someone to enforce the rules. These are not new issues. 6 years ago, the FTC awarded $50,000 to 2 inventors who came up with methods to defeat robocalls. And back in October 2016, the FCC, under then-chairman Tom Wheeler, gave mobile operators just 6 months to come up with and implement real solutions or he would impose new rules. Since Chairman Pai has taken over as the FCC boss, the regulator has been continually saying that robocalls are the FCC's top priority. And at congressional hearings last week, Pai was pressed on what the FCC was actually doing to tackle the problem. The answer has come back more of the same. The FCC robocall summit appears designed to give mobile operators another year before doing anything. The summit's goal, according to FCC, will be to feature stakeholders' discussions of lessons learned from major voice service providers that have begun to deploy call authentication technology in their own networks and test inter-carrier call signals. The technical barriers, if any, to deployment of Shaken and Stir by other major voice service providers, and challenges to deployment faced by smaller voice service providers, and the use of call authentication to reduce spoof robocalls and improve the consumer experience. In other words, another study. Well, what has the FCC done about robocalls? A robocalling scheme that ripped off business owners by claiming to be collecting fees on Google's behalf to improve their search engine result has been fined $3.4 million. Dustin Pelinato and Justin Ramsey were the main people behind Point Break Media and Modern Source Media and were taken to court by the FTC for their role in the robocall scam. The defendants tried multiple different ways of weaseling their way out of liability, but the district judge in Florida, Cecilia Altanaga, was having none of it, and they were both personally liable. She decided because they had taken part directly in the scams, including providing phone numbers and the merchant account through the money was funneled. The judge also rejected the pair's efforts of corporate confusion by throwing out arguments that the two companies were different entities, pointing out that they use the same merchant accounts, databases, sales scripts, and contracts. The scammers had tried to play a corporate shell game by shifting workers between different companies and subleasing workspace from one company to another in an effort to escape liability. But their efforts amounted to nothing. The judge also denied the defendants' efforts to get a jury trial by arguing that there was no triable issues to be decided. In short, Judge Altanaga appears to be as infuriated with robocallers as the rest of the nation. The FTC outlined the details of the scheme in its initial lawsuit filed back in May 2018. The company's robocalled people, many on the National Do Not Call Registry, claiming that their business was going to be removed Google's search engine because they had not claimed and verified their listing. I got one of those too. I just ignored it. That process could be done for a fee, the recorded message explained, but they would have to talk to a Google specialist to do so. That approach then opened the door to telemarketers who made various bogus claims, including that they could add keywords to their Google listings for a few hundred dollars. Once in the system, some of those that paid for the fake service was later contacted about another deal. Callers offered to guarantee a top search result placement for an upfront fee of $950 and a monthly payment of between $100 to $170. That was all nonsense. The judge issued summary judgments against the two, including a permanent injunction and a money judgment for $3,367,666.30, which is great in theory. One key issue is that both the FTC and its sister organization, the FCC, keep using the large fines levied against robocallers as evidence they are effectively clamping down on the practice. But the volume of robocalls continue unabated, and the fines are never collected, making the whole thing a charade. But it's worse than that. Since 2015, the FCC has fined the companies a total of $208.4 million, but according to an investigation by the Wall Street Journal, it has collected less than $7,000. That is pathetic. The FTC does a little better. Since 2004, it has fined companies a total of $1.5 billion and recovered just $121 million, giving it a recovery rate of 8%. The regulators aren't very open about their failure to get the money they so proudly announce, but in the related filing to this week's $3.4 million judgment against Point Break Media and Modern Source Media, the issue is clear. This week, the FTC filed a motion to vacate the $2.5 million judgment against another of the people caught up in the Google listing robocalling scam. Daniel Carver of Perfect Image Online and Pinnacle Presence, in return for him selling his Lexus if he sells a 2016 luxury vehicle worth about $20,000 and gives the money to the Federal Trade Commission, he's off the hook for the remaining $2.48 million. Similar deals were reached with another two related defendants, Jennifer Ramsey and Stephanie Watt. It's time to stop celebrating the FTC and FTC headline fine figures as a sign that they're doing their jobs effectively and start looking for real metrics, as well as start demanding explanations for the agency's failure to have any appreciable impact on the nuisance of robocalling. Presenting Benjamin Rockwell with his IT Pro Series, Tech Support, Part 4 or 5.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and I've been an IT professional for, oh wow, nearly 30 years. I'm here to share my knowledge from both sides of the technical support experience to make your life better, to make it easier. This is part 4 in a 5-part series on the technical support phone call and working it better to your advantage. If you've missed any part of this, go back to the podcast, listen to this. It's an amazing series. I've delivered this in seminars before, and I love this. Last week was about making the phone call. This week is about escalating that call to new levels. This transition from your current helper to the next one requires patience. It requires a polite attitude. All the way along, abusive language should be avoided. Any words that you don't want your 6-year-old saying, well, you have no business saying them at any point in time. Even if you get casual and relaxed and you think things are going well. And the reason for this is you might slip up. You might then extend those words throughout normal conversation. If you're of that type, I don't use those words, but I've heard this. So once you venture down the road of cursing, once you venture down the road of screaming or abuse, they can hang up. The technical support folks can mark you down as DNH. Do not help. That's the curse of being canceled. You may be escalated, or you may decide that you need escalation to the next level. Now, escalation to the next level on their side is great, as long as it's, you know, that nice, pleasant escalation where they say, I'm not sure I can help you. Let me get you on to the next technician. All right, but we need to also address getting your escalation. Now, I don't want you to be afraid to ask for the next level if the technician is not helping, but you need to be very nice. You need to be calm. You need to advise your concerns, also mentioning here and there that you know their time, the one that you're dealing with right now, is valuable. Two things can happen here. You can be escalated, which is good, or they'll resist. Now, I've met with resistance many times, but what I do is I slowly, here and there, in between the conversation bits, I build a case for escalation. I establish that I've already tried many things that I've heard them suggest here. I will, after a couple more, I may explain, hey, there's a logic error in this. I'm not sure that this is going to fix this because this is unrelated. What you're having me do is unrelated. Now, I do this in a kind manner. I explain also at this point in time that my problem appears to be beyond the script or beyond what their capabilities are. I do this nicely, and you may have to establish something different. Again, always do it nicely. You don't want to call back. That's the kiss of death. It does not fill your immediate needs. So you'll hear supervisors in some important meeting, and so are their bosses. So are their bosses' bosses. You really don't want to climb that high at once, but you also need to understand that you can ask for escalation to a boss. Nighttime is harder, but it's usually workable. You want to explain that you're seeking resolution now. You're not looking for a callback because you've lost faith in the promise of return calls. Not from your company, of course. I've had problems in the past with other companies. So if you must, I want you to insist on a call within a specific time frame. All right. You want to request also a point of escalation if no return call is made. So you're escalating me to Mary. She's going to call me back in the next 2 hours. If she doesn't, do you have her direct line? Let me note that down. Okay, great. Thank you. Your goal at a certain point, if you're no longer gaining ground, if you're no longer working towards resolution, is to work the cost numbers in your favor. Carefully. Remember that do not help issue. Well, until you're abusive, until you're foul, until you are aggressive, they actually shouldn't hang up. Now, how do you get leverage to get to that next level from somebody who's being stubborn? I know that you've already noted their names already. We've already discussed that previously. I want you to ask them to confirm their name again. Thomas, that was your name, right? Okay, Thomas, can you explain to me why I'm not being escalated? Surely you're not refusing escalation, are you? See what I've done there? So I've used their name, and I've also used that as an opportunity to ask for escalation, and why am I not being escalated? You laid out like that nicely. You make a plea. After a while, give them a chance to, you know, if they're stubborn, you're going to let them calm down a little bit. Make a plea explaining that you understand it's not their fault, but they do have power to help you by escalating the call. Empower them to transfer your call to someone who can help you. Calmly repeat your desire for escalation. You're going to lather, rinse, repeat, okay? After escalation, I want you to confirm the names and the titles. Be very careful. Note down, they sometimes will do a fake escalation to the person at the next desk. It's a peer. That's all right. Work it through again. And you can calmly repeat this process over and over again. I want you to ignore the previous levels. Do not beat up the supervisor for his report's inadequacies. That's going to be the kiss of death as well. Document the names, document the actions, and after a while, you're going to calmly request escalation again. Save your righteous indignation for people way up the level, way up on the high end of this food chain. And only then, when they actually completely, totally fail you, but yet you still want them to remain calm, collected, and impersonal. Do not get personal. Do not call them individually names. Next week, we'll cover what you do after the call. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. Buying a personal computer? At this time of the year, many high school graduates will be moving on to college. What computing equipment do they need? Check first with the school as to what is supported, and many schools offer students education discounts on supported hardware and software. You also have Father's Day and July 4th coming up, and you may be in on a gift-giving mood. Of course, the gift-giving may be to oneself. This is also the time when you find meaningful discounts for computers. What computer should I buy is a common question I'm asked. My initial response is to ask first, the one asking the question, what is your budget? How much money do you want to spend? Most people only think of the cost for the computing device, but you really have to look at the total cost for a system to be functional. If you're replacing an older system, you probably have to check if the existing support equipment is compliant with the operating system of any new equipment. There are issues of software drivers and cable interface connectors to be able to be used with the new equipment. You may also need to convert some or all of your history archival data. There's no point spending time looking at gear that isn't in your budget. Set yourself a budget before you begin, and don't forget to factor in software, printer, mouse pointer, external storage, and any other accessories. There is a law of diminishing returns with a sweet spot currently of around $500 to $1,000 for the computing hardware system that will do everything you need. Do you have a portability requirement? If you do, how much gear are you willing to carry? Total weight is a serious consideration, and you have to be brutally honest with yourself about what you're willing to carry with you when you're on the road. If you're not the kind of a person who wants to carry heavy equipment, then consider what your minimal computation requirements are when you are traveling. I see many college students today carrying their notebooks when traveling from one class to another. As a general rule, take any quote for battery usage between battery recharge and cut that in half. The result would be what you would realistically get from the notebook. Manufacturers' quoted battery usage time is based on measuring the system with the monitor screen barely lit and the CPU is in idle mode. Buy what you need today and don't worry about what you may need in the future. Don't invest in an overly expensive system configuration for tomorrow because tomorrow is going to be cheaper. If at all possible, physically look at and review the equipment model of interest or units similar to it from the same manufacturer. With notebook systems, there are variations not only in features but also in use. Not all keyboards have the same tactile touch. Don't assume all notebooks have the same features. Many notebooks no longer include an optical meter reader. Some don't have a display output port. Some don't have an Ethernet port. Some are only equipped with flashcard storage. Unless everything is done via cloud computing, this type of storage won't meet your needs. Not all notebooks have a built-in card reader. If you need a numeric keypad, only a 15-inch notebook has such a feature, and not all 15-inch notebooks have the numeric keypad. Ask yourself a simple question: what applications you expect to run on the computer. Don't assume the software is available for it. You won't find a tax prep program available for a Chromebook or a Linux notebook. A Chromebook also requires a compliant wireless printer unless you want to do cloud printing. This is strictly a personal preference. For family and close friends, I recommend a notebook in lieu of a desktop unit, even if there is no portability requirement. Why? Well, when there's a problem, I just tell them to just disconnect the wires from the notebook and pay me a visit. With a desktop unit, the reconnection of cables can be confusing, and the system unit may not lend itself to be easily moved. A common question I'm asked is, what about refurbished equipment? I only purchase refurbished equipment directly from the manufacturer. Refurb equipment from a retailer may have had equipment substituted. If you're buying a system for someone as a gift, try to gauge what they need and can effectively use. If that is not possible, then just make it a cash gift. Remember, whatever you buy, make sure you have included the media for backup. I have a postscript to this. If you're doing any gig work, in other words, freelance work, I strongly recommend you consider having available some minimal in case the equipment you are using becomes non-operational. It is a part of cost of doing business. This is equally true for those running a small office business. If Bitcoin is so safe, why does it keep getting hacked? Thieves have stolen millions of dollars in Bitcoin from exchanges. Hackers just stole $40 million worth of Bitcoin from Binance, one of the largest cryptocurrency exchanges in the world. It's hardly the first time crypto has been targeted by thieves. For a technology that's supposed to be hyper-secure, in practice, it's often proven itself to be not secure. Binance, which is based in Taiwan, announced last week that hackers were able to withdraw about 7,000 Bitcoin through a single transaction, amounting to $40 million. Hackers employed various methods, including phishing and viruses, in what the company described as a large-scale security breach. Withdrawals and deposits on the platform have since been suspended. Fortunately for Binance customers, the company will use its emergency insurance fund so customers won't personally incur any losses. But I still don't trust it. Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies have proven a prime target for hackers, despite their characterization by proponents as super safe and impregnable. One of the biggest such cases was in 2014, after losing $460 million, apparently to hackers. And in 2016, hackers stole $72 million worth of Bitcoin from exchange BitLinex. And in 2018, hackers stole $500 million in digital tokens from exchange CoinCheck. According to the Wall Street Journal, more than $1.7 billion in cryptocurrency has been stolen over the years, most of which has come from exchanges and been centered around Asia. The Binance heist, like the previous exchange hacks, should serve as a warning to cryptocurrency investors. Your money might not be as safe as you think it is. It's like robbing a bank, except you can do it from 1,000 miles away from the comfort of your home, and the money you get is virtually untraceable, and you can disguise it by laundering it through multiple wallets in a matter of minutes. Well, what did happen at Binance? According to a statement from Binance, hackers obtained user API keys, two-factor authentication codes, and other information to execute their plan and withdrew 7,000 Bitcoin in a single transaction. The hack impacted Binance's so-called hot wallet and is used for liquidity so Bitcoin could be exchanged. According to Binance, just 2% of the total Bitcoin holdings were in its hot wallet. The rest was presumably in cold storage, meaning Bitcoin kept offline. Had Binance kept more of its Bitcoin in its hot wallet, the hack could have been much worse. Binance said that their customers won't lose money thanks to its secure asset fund for users, an emergency insurance fund that it had in place since July 2018. What makes Bitcoin exchanges so hackable? Talking about Bitcoin security is a two-pronged discussion. One is the technology itself, and the other is how it's transferred and stored. Blockchain, the ledger technology upon which Bitcoin is based, is very safe and secure. It's an immutable, almost immutable record of who has transferred Bitcoins to whom. The problem of security is, who's allowed to make transactions on the blockchain? The answer is anyone who has the keys that match Bitcoins in a particular address. If you have your own keys, basically a set of letters and numbers corresponding to your Bitcoin, then, well, theoretically it's secure. But once you hand them over to someone else, such as an exchange or wallet for storage, then it's up to that organization's cybersecurity system and practices to keep the currency safe. Plenty of organizations have been susceptible to data breaches. Look at Equifax, Yahoo, and Target. Cryptocurrency exchanges are no exception. The thing with Bitcoin is that once it's gone, it's gone. You no longer have the key. Someone else does. That same fundamental security of the blockchain that you took advantage of, the hacker now does too. Unlike stock exchanges, which facilitate trading but don't actually hold securities on behalf of investors, many cryptocurrency exchanges charge fees for trading and store currencies for their customers. Analyst says that makes cryptocurrency exchanges like sitting ducks. Thieves that manage to break in can do something akin to robbing a bank, getting hold of valuable cryptocurrencies that you can cash out of. Cryptocurrency exchanges are easy to breach, with minimum effort and expense from attackers and with maximum return on investment. Regulations around Bitcoin vary by country. Some places require exchanges to follow stricter guidelines than others. When hacks do occur, international and national law enforcement agencies do get involved in attempting to track criminals down, and the penalties apply as they would any type of theft. In the United States, law enforcement agencies, such as the FBI, have taken action against thieves and other illegal uses of cryptocurrency. Marty Winston joined the club updating Windows 10. He was in the middle of a Windows update and it crashed without completion. He has been in touch with Microsoft to recover the system, and Microsoft was of no help to him. He spent the whole weekend putting in a lot of sweat work to recover the system. Well, he had to do a number of close change working on the system. Now he has to get all that laundry into the washing machine and dryer. Poor Marty, now he has to go up and down the stairs to the laundry room.
Okay, hang on a second. Before I get into this week's segment, I want to apologize to everyone for some compromises in my recording quality. It started a week and a half ago. It had been nagging me for days, and I finally told Windows Update that it could go do its thing. Well, that was a Saturday night, and it went off. Well, I went off to bed. It went off to do its thing, and on Sunday morning, I came back to a computer that could not or would not reboot. Its recovery files were gone. I spent 12 hours trying every trick I knew. I called Microsoft for support. After a couple of hours with Tier 1 support not getting either of us anywhere, I was escalated to Tier 2, and they called back the next day. That call was 2.5 hours. They made an appointment for me with a tech at the Microsoft store about 20 minutes from here. I went to Micro Center, bought a 2-terabyte Samsung SSD, figuring that if nothing else worked, when I went to the Microsoft store, I could do a clean install on the SSD, boot from there, and use my other 10 terabytes of drive space as data and backup drives. Well, that didn't work. Samsung tech support suggested not depending on the Microsoft SATA driver, and instead getting the SATA driver from ASUS. My motherboard is an ASUS X99 Deluxe, and it's been working fine for years. I did that. No difference. At the Microsoft store, the tech and I worked on it for 8.5 hours. By the time we were done, the system was booting fine to the small monitor in the store. So I brought it home. Now, my home displays, I have two. Both are 4K 43-inch Vizio TV sets. Now, everything, all the hardware in the house, was working just fine before that Windows update. You know, it's a pair of 4K 60 hertz monitors, 100% non-magnified graphics, and it just wasn't happening. It was blinking among various magnifications, various resolutions, and unvarying black. So back on the phone to Microsoft, Tier 2 support. Explanations, a remote session, lots of logs, and after several hours of, again, getting nowhere, an appointment for a call from Tier 3 support. That was Monday. It wasn't. It was a call back from Tier 2 saying they had talked to Tier 3, and Tier 3 said to go back to the hardware manufacturer. Are we forgetting that everything was working before Windows Update? Are we forgetting that Windows Update in this round is known to corrupt systems that have things plugged into USB, a warning I didn't get until too late? Every time they try to suggest that it might be a hardware problem, I pushed that right back at them. I reminded them that everything, all the hardware, was working fine before the Windows Update session corrupted my system. That's hard and fast evidence that there is not and could not be any root cause in the hardware, and that I would not accept passing the buck to anything other than an OS issue. Well, I spent last weekend going through my bag of tricks, except for the time I took to record this. And I was email disconnected for 3 days during that because my hosting company's Microsoft Exchange server platform went down from its own episode with an impolite Windows update. So I'm catching up as well as I can. I thought I'd have to record this segment on my notebook PC on a backup microphone in an unfinished basement room that's about as soundproof as the engineer's station on a steam locomotive, but instead, it's my production PC, which I got back to life, no thanks to Microsoft earlier today, and my good mic, but still, still in that same far from soundproof basement room. So, now that I've shared all that, let's get into the laundry. Often in these segments, I'll start with a premise, throw in some explanations, and end up with a big reveal of the ideal answer. But this time, I figured, hey, why not try to do it backwards? Won't it all come out in the wash? So this time, let me start with an ideal answer. And if you've been listening, you're aware of my penchant, my penchant for solutions that stay trouble-free for the long haul. Then I'll explain about how being ideal can work out differently, and I'll end up with a cluster of related things to think about. Ready for specifics? This is about your laundry gear. Yeah, the washer and the dryer. And I think that in an ideal world, it would be a speed queen up and down residential pair in a small laundry room just off your bedroom. I'll start with why these choices, then get into why you might want to make other choices. First, the most frequent question anybody asks about speed queen washers and dryers in a home, well, the answer is yes, they do have models for that, and no, the coin boxes are not standard equipment for them. Have a teenager, you might want one, but that's a special order. The Speed Queen brand is a stalwart of laundromats. That's where I first encountered them, where they get run hard and long but seem to just keep working. One big reason I looked into it is that where most household brands have a lot of plastics and polymers in their build, the Speed Queen counterparts of those parts are metal. Yeah, metal. The company says their stuff is made to last 25 years. Their up-and-down laundry pair, the SF7000W, weighs 380 pounds empty. You may want to reinforce the floor. Oh, by the way, add another pound for every pint of water, and don't forget the weight of your clothes in the washer, plus the dryer load. Make very sure your floor can handle the weight. And why near the bedroom? Well, it's because when you take off your dirty clothes, that's where you are. And when you need to put away your clean clothes, that's where they go. So why an up-and-down laundry pair? Because that way it takes up less floor space. All good things so far, right? But everything has trade-offs. The trade-off to the off-bedroom laundry center is that it more or less traps you there for too much of your day, at least on laundry day. And if it might have been convenient to let a load run when you go to bed, its sound might present a challenge to a sound sleep. The trade-off to the up-and-down pair is the upness and downness. There's some lifting and bending involved, no big deal for many people, but fairly significant for those with hip or back problems, for example. Hey, this isn't a brand consideration. Speed Queen also makes separates, and most brands offer up-and-down pairs. Maytag used to be the stalwart among retail consumer brands, but we checked, and they're not built the same as they were in the old days. Maytag, Amana, Whirlpool, GE, LG, Samsung, and the others, well, there's a certain sameness to their overall engineering. I would expect them to last only a fraction of the life expectancy of a Speed Queen, and that's a trade-off, because they only cost a fraction as much. Anyway, your washer and dryer are not things you shop for every day. For most people, you buy one of each the first time you move into a place that needs them, maybe an apartment, maybe a house, and you don't think about replacing either one until it breaks down and you have to. So I've said enough about these two items, but maybe not enough about the laundry room. When we moved in, the movers connected up the washer and let its outflow hose hang over the edge of a utility sink in the laundry room, fairly common. My wife started a load of clothes and we sat down to lunch. After a few minutes, I heard the sound of water on the floor. The hose hadn't been fastened, and the pressure of expelled water sent it rocketing away from the tub. I hit a button to stop the washer, and as my wife started mopping up the water, I headed into the basement to find a long zip tie. Well, it was raining in that corner of the basement, through the floor above and onto, of all things, my wonderful Sjoberg's workbench, plus my wooden drawer stack furniture. I dried and cleaned those, found the zip tie, and fastened the hose to a hole near the lip of the sink. Crisis over, back to lunch, but only for a few minutes. That sound of water again. This time, some of the wet rags that were draining in the utility sink slid down, or maybe Lawman Murphy pushed them down, where they blocked the drain. An easy cure, but the waterfall off the edge of the overflowing sink nonetheless gave us the same aftermath to address. Well, we replaced that utility sink with a bigger one, added a proper saddle mount for the hose, and even bought an in-wall hookup box, but I ended up returning that on the advice of the plumber, who explained quite credibly that it would need to go into an outside wall, opening up a lot of future problems with maintenance and an ongoing problem with insulation, including some chance that the bitter cold of the blizzard belt winters up here could freeze the water in those connections and create even more problems. No thank you. One problem we have not yet had, and I have the answer in one of the moving boxes but haven't found it yet, is a way to automatically handle the disaster, and I mean a disaster that can happen, when a clothes washer's feed hose bursts. We're talking up to 500 gallons an hour and a repair bill with four or five figures to the left of the decimal point. The gizmo I have is a LeakSmart washing machine appliance kit. It's made by Waxman Industries, a Cleveland company about 40 minutes away from me right now. This is a closed-loop system with a simple control unit, a water sensor that goes on the floor behind the clothes washer, a wall-wart power supply, and two screw-on motorized valves that go between each of the hot and cold hoses and the 3/4-inch water supply that they usually screw into. Water on the floor sounds an audible alarm, and in less than 5 seconds, it makes the water supply to the washer shut down, both hot and cold. If you're considering something like this, the LeakSmart washing machine appliance kit gets a green light from me. Next time, absent any new monkey wrenches in my personal and professional clockwork, I'll be talking about flooring and some of the new tech that dramatically shifts the choices there.
Thank you, Marty. Public service announcements. Computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. The computer clubs have random access sessions at each of these club meetings. If you have any questions or need for technical advice, the club members are more than happy to assist. There is no such thing as a dumb question. The Brookdale Computer Users Group will have a presentation on a look back at the club's history and a personal journey, Thursday, May the 23rd, and they meet in the Middletown Library Lodge Meeting Room, located at 55 New Monmouth Road in Middletown, New Jersey. The Princeton PC Users Group will meet Tuesday, May the 28th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. at the Mercer County Library in Lawrenceville, New Jersey. The Danbury Area Computer Society has their meeting on Tuesday, June 4th. Meeting time is 7:30 p.m. and is held at the Danbury Hackerspace, 158 Main Street, Danbury, Connecticut. The Westchester PC Users Group will have a presentation on ADA's driverless cars, Thursday, June the 6th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. at the Keller Williams Realty, 120 Bloomingdale Road in White Plains, New York. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey will have their meeting on Friday, June 7th. Meeting time is 8 p.m., and they meet at the Scotch Plains Rescue Squad, 1916 Bartle Avenue in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. If you have a computer club meeting you want me to announce on the air, send me a note. My address is hank@pcradioshow.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm on the Internet. Podcasts are available from all major podcasting host sites, as well as our website, pcradioshow.org. If you have any questions for us or commentary on any of our feature segments, just send us your email address with your telephone number, in which we can call you at a convenient hour for playback on the program. If you have any questions for us, just send us your email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. There is no such thing as a stupid question. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station, next week.